Hi, welcome to Info Dumpies. My name's Brianne. I'm autistic, I have ADHD, my pronouns are she, her, and I think you're just a fucking cockchafer beetle. I said it.
Hi, I'm Violet, I have ADHD, my pronouns are she, her, and I have a special gland in my body that makes it so potato chips is vitamins for me.
Oh.
Yeah. It's the crunch-em-up gland.
The crunch-em-up gland. I think yep. I found that whilst exploring each other's bodies.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's sort of like an external, like a...
An external gland, yes.
You know how cats have like a primordial pouch?
Yes.
It's nothing like that.
Nothing like that at all.
Yeah,
I do. So today is Mini Dumps. And if you have not joined us before, Mini Dumps is where we talk about topics that are very interesting on their own, but maybe not enough to make a full episode of Info Dumpies. So Violet and I both come to you and to each other with topics. I said come, and Violet's eyes are huge. We pick different topics. We don't tell each other what they are in advance, so sometimes we get a weird array of things. But yeah, they're things that are worth talking about, but not enough for a full episode. Do you feel like starting us off today, Violet?
Yeah, I'm totally down for that. I like to think that I should go first, because what I want to talk about is horses that go first things. Yeah. I picked this topic because I know you love horses. And
yes.
I was just really curious. There's so much variety in horses. What is I wanted to do a horse topic because I know you like horses, obviously.
Okay.
Yes, obviously. I was like, what can I do? So I started just looking up amazing horses. And the first one that I found...
Things I Google when high.
Yes. Well, yes, exactly. This topic came to me while I was, in fact, high. And I searched on DuckDuckGo, amazing horse.
Incredible. I love you.
That was the first search. But eventually, I got to better things. The first horse that I want to talk about, I'm sure you've probably heard of. It's one of the fastest horses that has ever horsed. Have you heard of a horse called Secretariat?
Oh, hell yeah. And there's a movie about him.
There is about him. Yeah. Or her. I didn't write down the gender.
I forget Secretariat's horse sex.
Oh, I think I put he in one spot, but I don't know if that was me assuming.
I might be wrong. I don't.
Oh, heavens.
Nickname Big Red. Tell me if that horse had a wiener.
Oh, wait, hold on. There's a picture here, and I do see a wiener, actually. There's a little bit of a foreskin showing. I do have several pictures that I want to be... I'm going to be sending Brianne that will be included in the notes on our Patreon, if you're one of our Patreon supporters. Obviously, the first horse that I want to talk about is Secretariat. Secretariat was, for the longest time, the fastest horse. And for a very, very long time, I should say. It took many, many years before a horse would break their record. And
his
I should
record.
Say...
It's his record.
His record. Okay, okay. Yeah. I was not sure. But yeah, let's go with his. But yeah, it would be a very long time before his record would be broken. And I want to say, at first I was very excited. I was like, wow, this is like just the fastest horse. And then I learned there's so many different categories...
Oh, yeah. For what type of race they were the fastest at?
The horse race that Secretariat had the record in for the longest time, and I think still technically has the record in, is the 1.5 mile classic distance record. So
my horse history, for those who don't know, I grew up riding horses. My first job was mucking out stalls. I had a horse given to me because he was a little dickhead and he had a degenerative foot disease, which it's fine. We had a good time and I didn't use him for shows for long. But the things I did were not these types of races. I did Western riding. I did mostly horsemanship and Western pleasure, which sounds like it should be someone's country album name, and bridleless. And I did bridleless competition. So basically no saddle, no bridle, just foot cues and vocal cues and vibes. So when it comes to like Kentucky Derby, I actually don't know a whole hell of a lot because I didn't do that kind of stuff. I dabbled in barrel racing. That's the closest I got to like timed stuff. But again, that's like 13 seconds.
Yeah. And this was Kentucky Derby that the Secretariat was in. And According to the legend, he set an unbroken record of 2 minutes and 24 seconds over 1.5 miles. And I say unbroken because that distance, I don't think that record has been broken. However, there are horses who have demonstrated a higher average speed than Secretariat. And I looked up a few. The fastest average speed of a horse ever recorded is Winning Brew, who I believe is a currently living horse, by the way. For context, Secretariat's average speed for that race was 37.5 miles per hour. Winning Brew's average speed for their 2-furlong race, which is a quarter mile, much shorter, obviously, was 43.97 miles per hour. So nearly 10 miles an hour faster. Obviously, that's a sprint. We're talking about a quarter mile. Secretariat's race was 6 times as long, so the average is going to come down.
That's like comparing a sprinter to a marathon runner. It's like...
Exactly.
Both good at running, different skill sets. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. But there's also some other ones in similar categories. So half that distance at 220 yards, which is a quarter horse sprint, we have Captain BD at 42.88 miles per hour. And then the fastest single sustained mile ever recorded was by Dr. Fager, the horse, not the doctor.
Cool.
Yeah, at 41.38 miles per hour average, which is just so fast, like a full mile.
Exceptionally fast.
Yeah, that's not much slower than Winning Brew at the sprint speed, but it was 4 times the distance, which is just wild. So that's the fastest horse. What about the biggest horse? Do you know who the biggest horse is off the top of your head?
I mean, I imagine it's some draft horse, obviously.
Yes.
I don't know the current. I would say like a Belgian draft, probably, if I'm looking at like breeds of horses.
I'm not sure if this is a breed, but in my notes, I have a Shire horse.
Oh, yeah.
Named Samson.
Yeah. Oh, Samson.
Samson. So Samson stands 21 and a quarter hands tall and weighs 3,360 pounds.
Wait, how many hands did you say this lad is?
21 and a quarter, approximately 7'1". Yeah.
Holy
and
fuck.
For the viewers at home that are not horse familiar, which I have become now horse familiar, a horse's height is measured from the withers, not the top of their head, which it's basically their horse shoulders.
Their horse shoulder, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So standing head fully straight up, Samson's head would probably be like 8 feet high.
That's wild.
And actually, there's a recent horse that is not bigger than Samson. By the way, Samson had the nickname Mammoth. I don't know if you knew that. There's another more recent horse that is a Belgian draft horse, I think you called that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Who lived up until 2021, and his name is Big Jake.
Big Jake.
And Big Jake was 20 hands and 2.75 inches tall. So 6'10 3/4, basically.
That's so big. That's so big. Fucking big. So my horse, Sonny, S-O-N-N-Y, not like the character from today's Lucky Winner. His name was Sonny's Best, his full name, because there was a quarter horse named Sonny D-Bar that was like very big in breeding, and he got the name Sonny's Best. He was a big boy.
Hell yeah.
He was only 16 hands high.
Wow. That's, yeah.
Big J.
Do you know how many? I'm not good at doing the conversion in my head. 16 hands, so that's like
hand
a
is
little
about
under
4 inches, right?
Whose hand we talking? Shorter
than
Big J.
It's standardized to equal 4 inches.
Okay, yeah.
I was right.
Oh, okay, cool. Awesome. So about 19 inches shorter than Big Jake, if you can imagine that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
massive.
Which is wild.
Fucking massive.
That's big horses. What about little horses?
Okay, so I personally, they're great to look at. I believe that every horse has a certain concentration of evil in them. And that when they're large, it's the same as the evil when they're small, but there's more horse for the evil to bounce around in. So the smaller the horse, it's the same amount of, so like the tiniest horse has the same amount of evil in them as your Big Jake's, but it's just in a smaller horse and has nowhere else to go but outwards at you. All of my experience with like miniature horses They have been the meanest horses I've ever interacted with, so I enjoy looking at them. Oh, gosh. Okay. This guy looks so tiny and probably so evil.
So that is the smallest horse to ever, Thumbelina. Thumbelina was 17 and a half inches tall.
Oh, gosh.
And weighed 57 pounds.
Oh, That's my gosh.
Only slightly more than Falchio, one of our dogs. Yeah.
Our little pity.
Yeah. She was born with dwarfism, and she lived a fulfilling life visiting schools and hospitals as a trained therapy horse.
Okay, see, this tells me that she did not have the concentrated evil. Yeah. I bet they worked the evil out of her if she was visiting children.
Honestly, the two smallest horses that I have listed here, because I have another one, a more recent one, they both are trained therapy horses. So I think that's amazing. How they get the evil out of them. They squeeze
they get the evil
out.
They train them for therapy and for caring. Yeah. The barn I worked at, whenever they would have a miniature horse show, people were literally drawing straws to see who was left to work the shift because kicked, bitten, all kinds of stuff. God. even when you're paying attention. I'm very good at my horse etiquette. I swear to God, one of these horses put their leg out to kick me sideways somehow. Sideways. Like, oh, I want to get you. And I just, it's like, you walked over here. I was already here. Anyway.
Yeah. They need to go. Same amount of evil. Yeah.
So they need to train to be therapists. To get the evil out of them.
The next, not quite as small as Thumbelina, but the next smallest horse, the smallest living horse, who this little baby horse is still alive, is Pumuckle.
Pumuckle.
Pumuckle. Pumuckle also, I'm going to send you a photo, has a luxurious mane. Ooh. And they're so fancy.
Oh my God. Pumuckle, so, what is your hair care routine?
So, Pumuckle is the world's shortest living horse, and they are 21.1 inches tall at the withers.
So little.
Also a trained therapy horse. And gosh, just, they're like a much longer hair breed than Thumbelina was.
So fluffy.
And just so scruffy, fluffy. I love it.
So scruffy.
It's important to note also that I don't think Thumbelina was, and I know for sure that Pumuckle was not bred to be a very, very small horse. Just born that way, baby.
I think here's the thing. The ones who are bred to be small are probably the ones full of evil. The ones who just happen to be small. It's just like, I just happen to be small, man.
That makes sense. Yeah. They're not breeding the evil into the
gene yes.
pool. Yeah. I know money is evil. So what about the most expensive horse? How evil would that be?
Oh God, that gets ridiculous. Because they'll charge you an arm and a leg just for some horse jizz.
So the most expensive horse, at least the one that I could see that sold for the most amount of money, is a horse named Fusaichi Pegasus, a Japanese-owned American thoroughbred racehorse who won the Kentucky Derby in 2000 with a 1.25 mile time of 2:01. And he was the son of Mr. Prospector and Angel Fever. I love
horse
that.
Names are so fucking good.
I might at some point do a separate info dumpies on horse names. I genuinely
that would be great. You could create some kind of game to see if it's horse name or something else.
I almost I like that.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know what the something else is.
Putting that in the pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Would you care to guess how much Fusaichi Pegasus sold for?
I don't know that I will be anywhere in the ballpark. I have seen $1 million horse before, and I know that's expensive, but not the most expensive.
It's a lot more than that.
Yeah, I know. And I saw this $1 million horse, and I was like, that's a horse. Cool.
Yeah. Honestly, looking at this horse, I would not tell you, not be able to tell you that this is not just a horse.
A horse, this... fast horse.
This horse is $70 million.
Jesus Christ. Beautiful, 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 beautiful bay horse. Coloring on Fusaichi Pegasus.
Next, I want to talk about the oldest horse. The Ooh. Oldest horse to ever live.
Oldest live horse to ever horse.
The oldest horse to ever horse. He was horsing for so long. He was horsing around. He was born in 1760 And whoa, he lived to be 62 years old.
Whoa!
Old Billy. His name is Old Billy. There's paintings of Old Billy that depict him as a large cob slash shire horse, brown in color with a white blaze. Billy became a barge horse in England, pulling barges along canals. Very strong boy. So a domestic horse's lifespan is typically 25 to 30 years. And for ponies, up to 40 to 50 years if you're very lucky.
Yeah.
This horse lived 62 years and had the same owner for almost the entire time. Billy's taxidermied skull now resides in the Manchester Museum in England, which is kind of wild. It's weird looking. I wouldn't look it up. But there's a lithograph that shows Old Billy with Squire Henry Harrison, who, quote, had known the animal personally for 59 years, and a portrait of him is held at the Warrington Museum and Art Gallery. The reason I mentioned the taxidermied head, which is honestly a bit gruesome, there were a group of local artists in 2024 that wanted to have his head brought back to his hometown in Warrington, and so they established the Bring Back Old Billy Committee.
Hell
and
yeah.
Successfully got him brought back home, so good for them.
I was gonna say, I'm not even British, but I'll sign the petition.
I hope the ghost of Old Billy is living it up in his hometown and just
with his friend Squire something.
Yeah, exactly. Highest jump on a horse was done by a horse named Wasso, ridden by a Chilean army officer, Captain Alberto Larraguibel, in 1949. Would you care to guess how high this jump is? And by the way, this is one of the longest running, unbroken sports records in history.
I don't really know about dressage because I didn't do English, but I'm going to guess 15 feet high.
That's much higher than it actually was. It was 8 feet, 1 1/4 inches high, but that's crazy high.
That's really high. I know nothing about jumping.
Yeah. That's like jumping over Big Jake, clear over Big Jake. And I'm going to use Big Jake as a unit of measurement for now.
We will use anything but the metric system, won't we?
Yes. The wildest part about this is that this happened in 1949, and the reason it's one of the longest running unbroken sports records in history is because there's fucking video evidence of it. There is a video from 1949 of this jump happening. I watched the video. It's really, really cool. I put a link to it in the Patreon notes if you'd like to go watch. It's in Spanish, but like you don't need to speak Spanish or
horse
to
jump.
Appreciate this. Horse jump
horse
is real
jump.
Good.
Horse jump
it. It's honestly wild. It looks like the horse in like the video is jumping like twice its own height. It looks unreal. It's really amazing. And there's actually a quote that I found from the Captain Alberto, who said, "As for me, it was like sending my heart flying over the other side of the jump and then going to rescue it."
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever been on a horse while it's jumping, because I didn't do English, but sometimes the barn that my horse was at and that I worked at would host shows that were English shows. So they would leave their shit up, and sometimes I would go be like, let's see, let's try. I felt like my heart was about to fall right out of my ass. It's so scary jumping on a horse.
Right? I couldn't imagine jumping 8 feet in the air on a horse. I couldn't imagine jumping on a horse.
I couldn't imagine.
Like, I couldn't imagine jumping on a horse. I couldn't even fathom jumping 8 feet in the air on a horse. It's mind-blowing.
No.
You mentioned dressage earlier. I know you're not super familiar with dressage, but apparently there's like a percentage scoring system of some kind. The highest ever dressage score was earned by a horse named Vallegro. I think Vallegro. That sounds better when I say it out loud. Ridden by a rider named Charlotte Dujardin. And Vallegro achieved a near mythical freestyle score of 94.3%, which apparently, I looked this up, getting over 90% is like unheard of.
Wow.
So yeah, and this was back in 2014. Charlotte Dujardin is a bitch, because apparently in 2024 a video surfaced of her being mean to a horse and hitting a horse and abusing
it. She can rot in the worst hell imaginable.
Yeah, she dropped out of the Olympics and is disgraced. Good riddance. So
good.
You know what, Vallegro is retired, and I hope they're having a great horse time doing stuff.
Yeah, without that bitch.
The last one I want to talk about, the longest mane slash tail on a horse, This looks like a freaking My Little Pony. This is JJS Summer Breeze, which is
what a
majestic name. I don't know what the JJS stands for, but JJS Summer Breeze. It's like a cruise ship. JJS Summer Breeze holds the Guinness World Record for a tail officially measured at 12 feet 6 inches long.
Whoa.
Yeah. Here's the wild part. That record was set in, like, I think 2008 or something like that. There was an interview that her owner did with her own horse, where she, like, answered for her horse. It was kind of weird, but she did an interview where she said, since the record was taken by Guinness, it's grown to 13 feet 6 inches, a whole other foot.
Whoa.
It's wild. So I was really curious as to how a horse gets around with a tail this long, right?
You gotta braid that, put that in a little hairdo, do a little hairstyle.
Yeah. I looked it up. Her owners take very good care of her to ensure that her tail is never stepped on. Her tail is usually wrapped up in a little horsey braid bun on her butt.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was imagining. Yeah. I love these amazing horses. Thank you. Yeah.
Absolutely. I love you.
I love that you got high and Googled amazing horses.
It was fun to do and fun to present.
We were on a similar animal wavelength because my first topic is queer animals.
Oh, I love queer and animals.
Yeah. So kind of inspired by you talking about gay penguins. Ooh. I was like, are there any other... I mean, obviously, I know there are other gay animals, right? But are there some really interesting ones, and are there ones that meet some of the other letters of under the LGBTQIA umbrella that are worth mentioning?
I'm so hyped.
And when did we first start looking at gay animal stuff, right? Like, when did we first start noticing that? So we've already covered
a section in here about furries. Sorry, I don't.
Damn,
that's okay.
But yeah, so I'm not going to talk about gay penguins. If you want to hear about gay penguins, go listen like a couple info dumpies ago. So some of these I'm just going to truck through. Some of them we're going to spend a little longer on. The first ones, the perverts of the deep, the bottlenose dolphin.
Mm. Yeah,
not perverts because they're gay. Perverts because dolphins have some terrifying behaviors that are upsetting that I won't go into in this podcast because we try to have fun. But besides that, bottlenose dolphins have been found to have male-male relationships. They hunt together, they fuck, and they travel together, sometimes carrying this relationship on with the same male partner for decades.
Have you, and you might be getting to this, but have you heard of lesbian dolphins?
I didn't find anything about lesbian dolphins.
I wonder what it is.
So next, we're going to talk about bonobos.
Monkeys.
Well, apes.
Apes. You're right. My bad. Apes, I forgot whether or not they have tails. My bad.
Bonobos, with whom we share 99% of our DNA, more often have homosexual than heterosexual encounters.
Whoa. Gay apes.
They're mostly considered bisexual. Bonobo societies are run by groups of female primates who have a bunch of gay sex together.
Hell yeah.
So they have a sapphic bisexual polycule that runs things.
Amazing.
And primate experts believe that heterosexual sex among bonobos is not actually just for procreation, but a way to keep harmony among the group. So it's like a team building exercise.
Oh, fun. Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. So when we lived back in Texas, James and I would like to go to the Fort Worth Zoo a lot because they have a really extensive primate area. And part of it, you can go inside and watch them when they want to come inside to escape the heat. I love getting violently high and watching the bonobos because they also would do shit like get to the highest point they could and pee on everyone else.
I too have an extensive primate area. I don't know what that means, but yeah, let's go for it.
So next are clownfish.
Like Finding Nemo. Nemo's dad.
Nemo would be a clownfish logically. Like his dad. Yeah. But what you didn't know about Nemo and Marlin? Is his name Marlin?
I think his name's Marlin.
What you didn't know about their society is that clownfish groups are always led by a female. Her second in command is always male. When the female in charge dies, The second in command becomes the new leader and also transitions sex to female.
Hell yeah. I support this entirely, and I hope that they get name and gender marker changes too.
Yeah, and I imagine in clownfish society they would. There are about 500 known fish species who change sex in adulthood.
I didn't know that. That's so cool.
So now we're going to get to a guy who I'm very excited to talk about.
Yeah?
Are you familiar with Jonathan the giant tortoise?
No, but I want to be.
He is the oldest known living land animal. He is 192 years old.
That's so much. That's so much old. Oh my God.
He saw the Civil War.
I'm so sorry for him for having to see that. My God.
Jonathan the giant tortoise is also gay.
Hell yeah.
Jonathan was introduced to another giant tortoise in 1991 named Frederica. And the two were instantly inseparable.
Oh.
They did everything together, and they still do. They're still both still alive and still together.
Oh, good.
Including having a lot of tortoise sex. It wasn't until 2017 that they discovered that they had fucked up determining Frederica's sex. Frederica is a male tortoise.
Oh my God.
So they renamed him Frederick. And wow. He and Jonathan spend all of their time together.
Good for them.
Jonathan is mostly blind, and he's lost a lot of his sense of smell, but he spends his days eating, sleeping, and having gay sex with his tortoise husband, Frederick.
And I presume that Frederick is a younger beau.
Yes, I do. I think he snagged himself a younger chap.
Oh,
but like younger for tortoises though. It's like,
yeah, like
oh, a spry 120. Oh.
Yeah. Ooh. Robbing the cradle. The tortoise cradle.
He is a giant Seychelles giant tortoise. As far
giant
as variety. Giant gay shell tortoise. So the first time homosexuality was undeniably observed and written about in the scientific community was in a European beetle. Called the cockchafer beetle.
Holy shit. I was waiting for the word that you used in your intro to come back, and oh, wow.
It's also amazing. Known as a doodle bug.
Holy shit. It's got the two best names that something
yes.
can have. A cockchafer / doodle bug. Amazing.
The name is funny, and even more so when you learn what was happening in the gay sex that the scientists witnessed between these beetles. So
oh
for a
God.
Long time, scientists, when they saw homosexual behavior among creatures, they'd say, this must be a female that somehow developed male traits. Or, well, this must be some sort of dominance thing. Cockchafer beetles were the first time they're like, maybe they just like having gay sex.
Hell yeah.
So the cockchafer beetle has a little beetle dick, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, called an adagus. Adagus? A-E-D-A-E-G-U-S. Adagus.
Yeah, sounds about as right as anything to me. I don't know about beetle dicks.
Yeah, so I'm going to just be saying...
I do now.
I'm just going to be saying beetle dick. The male and female cockchafer beetles are extremely easy to tell apart just on sight.
Because they're huge beetle dick.
Just by sight.
Swinging dog.
Just by sight, they're easy to tell apart. Yes, just a swinging beetle dick. This is why scientists were able to immediately identify that they were watching two male beetles fucking. And I'm going to get a little I'm going to get a little anatomical about beetle dicks here.
Listen, any beetles listening, keep it cool, all right?
NSFW. They did this by one beetle pushing their little beetle dick into the other beetle's beetle dick to push it back up into their little beetle body. So, cockchafer indeed.
Beetle docking, I think, is what that would be.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Cockchafer, indeed. So,
well, I hope they're not chafing.
Scientists argue
it's well lubricated.
I one would hope. I don't know about beetles. scientists argued that it must be one beetle using this to dominate another, or that somehow one beetle must have been female. Though this behavior was seen again and again and again and again with the goddamn cockchafers. Russian entomologist Carl Robert Austin II observed that it was often the larger beetle being penetrated. So it wouldn't make sense to say that this one beetle was coerced into this act as a display of domination because the inarguably more powerful beetle is bottoming. He ended his conclusions by saying, "The interesting philosophical considerations which arise from such abnormal phenomena, I leave to the reader himself to address."
Amazing. Wow. So these short king tops are topping their big bottoms.
Yes. Yeah.
I love it. Amazing. Good for them.
Twinks can be tops too.
Put that on a t-shirt with a beetle on it. Yeah. Okay, that's what we need. A shirt with a cock
chafing twink.
Yeah. Cock chafing twinks can be tops too.
Okay, so now we're at our final animal, who I think should probably be like a mascot to the trans femme community. And that is the female spotted hyena.
Yes. I love it already.
They have penises.
Yes.
They're called a pseudophallus. And it's unlike any other pseudophallus in the animal kingdom.
So is it just like a real big clit?
So some animals have a pseudophallus that is just a real big clit.
Okay.
Some of them do. The hyena can pee through hers, give birth through hers, and use hers for intercourse.
Amazing. Talk about a multi-tool.
Yeah, so the hyena pseudophallus is really like an external vagina.
That's crazy. I love it.
Female spotted hyenas are larger and more aggressive than males.
Oh, yeah.
And having a pseudopenis means that they have to 100% cooperate in the mating process.
That makes sense.
They get say in the mating selection because of their pseudopenises. Their penises are 90% as long as male hyenas. And they even have a pseudoscrotum.
What? That's wild. They got a pseudosac?
They got a pseudosac.
Oh my gosh.
Their pseudopenis even has erectile tissue. And
wow,
this is important.
That's so cool.
This is important for socializing. So scientists don't know why this is yet, but an erect female penis is a sign of submission in the female spotted hyena. The dominant female in the pack will be flaccid. We have not figured out why they do this yet.
Maybe to demonstrate that she's a shower, not a grower.
I don't know, but I thought that was amazing. I was like, wow, trans femme intersex icon. Like,
wow. Yeah.
I love
that's
you,
really
female
cool.
spotted hyena. Yeah. But yeah, that's some cool queer animal stuff.
I love it. It was a little graphic there towards the
it
end
did
with
get
the
graphic.
Beetles and the hyenas. But
yeah,
like,
no, I told you.
Cool,
I was like, I'm going to get a little... What some might say is gross, but to me, it's just anatomy. So
yeah, it's just anatomy. No, it's really cool. I know when it comes to taking care of our anatomy, something that you struggle with a lot, and not to put you like on blast or anything, or put your business out there, is food. Food is difficult for you a lot, right?
Yeah.
And I know there's been a lot of times where you've kind of expressed the thought of, I wish I could just have like one food to eat. And I don't have to think about it, you know?
Yeah, like a human kibble.
Yeah, human kibble. And we were talking about that a while back. And I was like, surely people have tried to come up with this, right?
Oh,
and of course, they have.
They have. So and most of
my
them are
second
awful.
Thing, yes. My second thing is single source nutrition or single source foods, right? Where it's one food and explorations into that, where you only need one thing to survive as a human. Essentially, human kibble. Although... what I found was a lot of examples of this were not in kibble form.
Probably drink form, right?
For reasons I will get to. Yes and no. Sometimes drink, sometimes like a jerky, interestingly
enough.
Oh, weird. Yeah. And you'll see what I mean here in a second.
They probably all taste like motor oil.
Well, not necessarily. So the first one that I want to talk about, you've probably heard of this in some form or another, especially having a parent that's in the medical field. This is total enteral nutrition. I think I'm saying that right. Enteral, E-N-T-E-R-A-L.
Enteral.
This is, scientifically, the singular food that humans have come up with. When you think of someone who's like on a feeding tube, typically what they're referring to is a tube that goes directly into the gut and it is delivering total enteral nutrition. Total enteral nutrition, or TEN for short, is a liquid formula engineered with the exact macronutrients and micronutrients to keep a human alive. though there are many different formulations, as of course there isn't one agreed upon formula that works for all humans, because we're all different.
So I actually have helped feed people with feeding tubes, because one of my jobs in my late teens, early 20s, was nannying for both autistic and medically complicated kids, and I have done this.
Yeah, that's why I was saying, I figured you've probably at least heard of this before.
Yeah.
Which, it's really cool that you've actually done that. As I'm sure you know already, 10 is fed directly into a person's gut, which preserves their immune system better than IV nutrition would do. And IV-based nutrition, where you're putting nutrients into the bloodstream directly, that's called TPN, which is total parenteral nutrition. And it uses the bloodstream to basically send your nutrients in like base nutrient form rather than having you digest things. It bypasses your gut, it bypasses your intestines and all that stuff, which in only some cases is truly necessary. TEN, by contrast, it supports the intestinal barrier, it prevents your gut from atrophying, and typically has much fewer severe complications than TPN does. And it's most commonly required for people with neurological conditions that impair the swallow function, such as stroke or Parkinson's disease or anything that makes it difficult to swallow. That was the first thing that I really came across when I was searching for single source nutrition. And I was kind of surprised that like more people don't mention that when they're talking about all the other like single source nutrition, like the monkey chow that people sometimes talk about. I'm sure you know, human kibble. Going back in history to something that I think is probably the oldest example of what I would call a superfood, where it's not necessarily meant for you to only persist off of, but it's meant to sustain you, assuming you don't have other things. And it's got a good variety of vitamins and minerals and nutrients, although it's not super tasty. Pemmican, yes, you beat me to it. Pemmican was invented by the indigenous peoples of North America, primarily the Cree, Ojibwe, and Lakota tribes. They basically would do it a variety of different ways. But what it essentially is a mix of dried, either pounded or powdered meat and a lot of fat, sometimes mixed with berries or other vegetables and fruits and things like that. But primarily it is meat and fat. A little bit of fruits in there sometimes, maybe for flavor and a little bit of extra vitamins. And it is all pounded very flat and dried into basically something like a combination between beef jerky and fruit leather with way more fat. And the fat is what is helping preserve it. So this is not only a superfood, it's something that you can just stick in your pocket for like a month and it will be fine.
Amazing.
To eat. The invention of pemmican and the sort of use of it was what allowed early Arctic explorers to survive the extreme cold and exertion without getting scurvy, because they had pemmican with, obviously, fruits and vegetables that had vitamin C in it. One thing that I didn't even consider to be, like, a single-source food that was really interesting when I was looking into this. Are you familiar with a beer called Doppelbock? Or have you heard of it? This would kill you instantly, because it's also called liquid bread.
Oh, yeah, it's alcohol and gluten.
Yeah, it's very gluteny. In the 1600s, Pauliner monks from Belgium created a heavy dark beer called Doppelbock, but at that point it was called Salvator, which apparently is like short or slang for liquid bread. They would make this to survive a 46-day Lent fast.
Whoa.
Yes. So for 46 days, they would have nothing but heavy, dark beer, which is wild to me, right? You can't possibly survive off of that. Well, apparently, this beer has a lot of carbs, it has a lot of calories, and surprisingly, a lot of B vitamins from unfiltered yeast.
Oh.
So you're getting a lot of what you need to survive. You know, you're not going to be feeling great, obviously.
No, but...
You're getting no protein.
Yeah. Right?
But you're surviving, which is wild.
Before my celiac genes said activation, I really liked dark beer, and I bet if it wouldn't hurt me now, I bet I would kind of like it.
I bet you would. When I drank beer any amount of frequency, and I was never much of a beer drinker, I did tend to like Guinness and darker beers, especially when they were very yeasty and bready. So I get it. I'm sure you are familiar with the term meat sweats, right?
Yes, I am.
Imagine surviving 365 days on nothing but meat. Imagine the meat sweats that you might have.
On the carnivore diet? Yeah.
Arctic explorer, and I'm going to butcher this very, very Icelandic name, Vilhjálmur Stefánsson.
Sure.
I think that's as close as I'm going to get. Who lived from 1879 to 1962. He's an Arctic explorer. He lived, purportedly, for 365 days on nothing but meat, fat, and organs to prove you could survive without plants.
All right, so the carnivore diet people have always been around then, huh?
I think that a lot of the carnivore diet stuff probably references this study, if you want to call it that.
That ain't a study. That's one guy saying, hi,
exactly.
I'm Stefánsson. Welcome to Jackass.
Well, there were two people, actually, I should say. So the study started in 1928. It was Vilhjálmur and Karsten Anderson.
You just sound like you're having an episode every time you say this guy's first name.
It's Vilhjálmur.
I don't know. Vilhjálmur?
That's where I'm at. Yeah, I don't know. Meat Man. So,
Meat Man.
1928, Mr. Meat Man and Karsten Anderson, a member of his expeditions that he would go on, participated in a Bellevue hospital experiment where the two men ate only meat for 1 year under supervision. I looked into this, right? Because it doesn't seem to me that it would make sense that the results that they would get from this said that they didn't show any major medical changes and that the men were in excellent health. They lost a little bit of weight and that's it.
They were checking for two things. None of it cholesterol, probably.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what they were checking for. The experiment was published in the Journal of Biological Chemistry in February of 1930 under the title Prolonged Meat Diets with a Study of Kidney Function and Ketosis. This study, quote unquote, they only actually supervised them. Like, these guys didn't stay in the hospital or stay in this place
the whole
time.
They ate other stuff.
Yeah. They were only actually in the hospital for, the first 2 months, I think.
They
for
ate
the
other
actual study.
Stuff.
Yeah. And then they were just doing it, quote unquote, from home for the last,
honor
10
system.
Months.
Honor system.
Right. Yeah. And they were doing regular checkups, sure. But it's like, bro, you expect me to believe that an Arctic explorer is going to survive on 365 days on nothing but meat and only lose a little bit of weight and have no other notable medical changes whatsoever.
Yeah, they ate other stuff.
NASA also has looked into this. Obviously, when you put people in space, you want to make it simple to feed them because it's really hard to get food in space. I'm not sure if you've heard of this.
Yeah.
You can't really go to the In-N-Out by Mars. It's closed. They closed it. So they don't.
I don't like them because they're religious anyway.
Yeah, that's the other. That's why they closed, actually. Yeah. They proposed a single nutrient paste for astronauts.
Ew.
I know. Yeah, paste. Ugh. So it was called the formula diet, and it was visualized as a tube-fed paste similar to food used in the early Mercury program when they were thinking about sending people to Mercury. The whole idea behind it being a paste was to prevent crumbs from getting into the equipment and from preventing spoilage, because when you have a paste, it's very easy to just make it
shelf
no
stable
water.
And
shelf stable, exactly. This was abandoned due to menu fatigue. Astronauts got so bored they stopped eating entirely. It's got to be really bad if they stop eating entirely.
Yeah. It's got to be real bad.
So that prompted some research into the psychological health necessity of food variety in humans.
I wonder, it'd be interesting if they were doing that, but also looked at autistic people as a comparison.
That's a good point.
Because,
I would be interested to see a paper
I've been
on that.
Rocking basically the same thing for weeks now. If I could have my way and always have those ingredients on hand all of the time, I would eat that longer.
That's true. There's certain foods that I'm like, I don't think I would ever get tired of this.
Except
now,
sometimes.
I've never been in a situation.
Except sometimes there's one day where my brain goes, you never want to eat that again. And I go, really? I just bought so much of it. It's like, yeah, you don't want to look at it anymore. It does happen. I don't know how the spell gets broken, but sometimes it does.
The good news is the research that they did on this was still used. And some of the early astronauts, like John Glenn, did eat pureed beef and vegetables from tubes. in their space flights. So,
oh, the texture.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Oh, it's like
beef flavored toothpaste.
It's gross. So moving on. You're familiar, I'm sure, with the classic line, Soylent Green is people.
Yeah, and I drank Soylent before my MCAS meant that I could not anymore. And I started reacting to it.
I used to drink Soylent as well. Yeah. Some of you listening may have also drank Soylent. Soylent is intended to essentially be what we're talking about, right? A single food. And in 2013, a guy named Rob Reinhardt created a synthetic slurry primarily of maltodextrin, oat powder, whey, and a variety of vitamins. And as kind of like a promotional stunt, lived on it for 30 days. And he did that successfully. Now, there was some stuff later on that came out about how his doctors were like, please, God, eat something else. but it happened. And it did basically spark the modern meal replacement industry, kind of as we know it. It's not actually named after the movie Soylent Green. It's named after the book the film is based on, which is called Make Room, Make Room by Harry Harrison.
That seems like a trivial distinction, but okay.
Rob Reinhardt basically is quoted as saying he named it after the thing in the book.
And so I don't know if you're going to cover this, but did you know that there was a little bit where you couldn't get Soylent in Canada and it could not be described as a meal replacement because it actually didn't meet Canadian food guidelines for a meal replacement shake?
Wow. I didn't know that.
They got bought out by Trump supporting company, and that's when we stopped getting it and I started reacting because I think they changed like the sugar in it or something. But
that makes a lot of sense. There have been a lot of YouTube videos. It was kind of a trend for a little while of people trying primate kibble, monkey chow, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, hey, if we're so similar, we share 99% of our DNA with 99% of our DNA with apes. Surely the food can't be that. Surely the food can't be that different, right?
I'm keeping my burp in. That was a good one.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was a really clean take. Before you go out and buy yourself a 5-pound bag of primate kibble, let me stop you. If you try to eat monkey kibble, your gut will not feel good. The amount of fiber in monkey chow is like 6 times your daily recommended value. If you try to eat it, you're gonna have poop problems. It's way too much fiber for you. I saw I watched a few videos of people trying this. I think the longest that I saw was somebody going 3 days eating nothing but primate kibble. And essentially, when I say kibble, this is like the size of an apple. It's like a ball, and you are eating an entire ball. That's how they give it to these primates, because it doesn't make sense to have like a bunch of little pieces. They're not using utensils. The easiest way to deliver this to a primate is in a like a ball form. It's like a giant hush puppy, basically. Much, much, much drier. Half fiber. It's bad. This guy went like 3 days, and he was like, my stomach hurts so bad, and I can't poop. And that was like the last. Yeah, like it was just really bad. But the last thing that I want to talk about, and the reason I saved it for last is because of the name, is a food called Plumpy Nut.
Oh, is it gluten-free?
It doesn't say, none of the primary ingredients are gluten, but it does have milk powder in it.
Oh, no. Okay, never mind. Yeah.
But the name Plumpy Nut is so good. The name is
so fucking good.
What it does and like who it's for is also very good. Plumpy Nut is a ready-to-use therapeutic food, or RUTF, used by UNICEF to treat severe acute malnutrition in famine zones.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so it's like super, super high calorie and easy to digest. It doesn't require any water, it doesn't require any cooking, and doesn't spoil even in extreme heat.
Amazing. Thank you, Plumpy Nut.
Good job, Plumpy Nut. It was made in 1996 to basically revolutionize malnutrition treatment, and I think it did that quite well because previously, children had to be hospitalized to receive therapeutic milk, which required clean water and refrigeration and a whole bunch of other stuff that's often not available in a famine zone, obviously. It was invented by Dr. André Briand, a French pediatric nutritionist, and Michael Lescan, a food processing engineer. The inspiration behind Plumpy Nut was actually a jar of Nutella.
Oh.
They realized that a lipid-based paste would perfectly resist bacterial growth because it lacks water entirely. And before settling on peanut paste, they actually tried making biscuits and bars and pancakes and even donuts. But all of that, of course, is too hard to store, too fragile. Yeah. The early Plumpy Nut also actually was so high in fat content that it would degrade the paste holding the packaging together.
Whoa.
And like, yeah, like melt it open, like oil degrading an oil-based glue. But he was actually, Dr. Briand has changed so many lives with their Plumpy Nut. So yeah.
Amazing. An incredible name.
Yeah. And I think the company that makes it, like the parent company, is called Plumpy Field.
Incredible.
I think someday, although it does have milk paste in it, I kind of want to try a Plumpy Nut.
Yeah, I got a fucking Plumpy Nut for you. I'll chew a fucking Plumpy Nut for you. Well, my final topic, and is something I enjoy, but I've had a couple clients recently who are like, I really wanting to have something to do with their hands, didn't have hobbies that involve something simple to do with their hands. And we were discussing those types of hobbies because they're really good for helping you regulate, especially those ones you can easily do with your hands that are repetitive. So I will be talking about sashiko.
Oh, fun. You've been doing a lot of that lately.
I've been doing a lot of that for the past couple of years because I wanted to get really good at it.
Time is a flat circle.
Time is a flat circle. I say lately,
it really has been.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of it lately because I'm at the point where I'm able to fix more things. So for those unfamiliar, sashiko is a Japanese style of embroidery, literally meaning little stabs.
What a cute little name.
What a cute little name.
Little stabs.
So while it's decorative and a lot of it, a lot of what's done with it is decorative, it's used to visibly mend and reinforce damaged or worn fabric. I love using sashiko, and it makes me less bummed when there's a tear in something in the house because I know I can fix it and I know I can make it look nice. Personally, I think trying to fix something and have the mend not be visible is harder. Trying to just make a secret fix. So if I can make a fix where I put something cute on it, it's like, see, I fixed it, but also it's pretty.
Yeah.
I think it's not like it takes less skill. It's a different skill, and it's one that I'm better at. So currently, I'm using sashiko to fix some damaged parts on a quilt that James's grandmother made, because it works really well to reinforce blankets. Sashiko, historically, used 100% cotton thread and indigo-dyed blue cloth, because both were cheap and readily available. So most traditional sashiko you see will be white thread on blue fabric. So the thing I like about sashiko is it uses one stitch. It's a single stitch. You don't have to learn a bunch of stitches like with a lot of other embroidery. It uses just a simple running stitch. When you think of the platonic idea of hand sewing something, the stitch where you go in and out of the fabric, up, down, running stitch. This makes it a lot easier to pick up than some other embroidery stuff because it's just one stitch you have to use.
And I know I've seen the patterns that you can make with it, so it must just be about like placement and spacing.
Placement, right? And how you space the patterns and how you draw them out before you do it. That's I was about to say. The simple running stitch can be made into all sorts of patterns. There are geometric patterns are really common. You can use a water-soluble marker to kind of plot out your own patterns and shapes. Like, literally just get a marker and a ruler and you can make your own sashiko pattern.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So, yeah. Sashiko emerged in the Edo period in Japan. And by the Meiji period, which begins in 1868, sashiko was so culturally established, it became considered winter work in northern farming communities when it was too cold to work outside. So you'd spend your time inside when it was too cold, mending your clothes to like refresh everything for the year, mending things like sleeping mats. If you look up some traditional sashiko stuff, you'll see some really beautiful garments that someone has mended to the point where it's like a Ship of Theseus situation.
Me and fiber art, I just have a hard time getting started. This is, I think, helping me get over that hurdle? Because now I'm thinking of like a couple things that I need to mend that I'm like, maybe I should just visibly mend them rather than trying to invisibly mend them.
Yeah. And like historically, it would be used to patch clothing the same way I'm doing it, and to add some reinforcement at points of wear, and often to make thin fabrics warmer, because the repeated running stitch through the original fabric and adding new fabric at the end, the fabric you've done the sashiko patch on is so much stronger than even the original garment when it was new.
I wouldn't think that just adding a bunch of thread would make it warmer, but I guess you add enough thread, it's trapping more air, more insulated.
And those fibers are going to blend and kind of merge with the patch and the original fiber you have. And those little itty bitty 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 fibers kind of stick together more. And yeah, it's warmer.
That's really cool.
One of the coolest uses historically that I found for them in Japan was how sashiko is used on firemen's coats.
Ooh.
So they would use sashiko patches to make the coats thick and absorbent. And then they would soak those coats in water for protection for when they went to go fight fires.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
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 I mean, like, I imagine it's really heavy.
Yeah, but
like,
in,
so
the,
eight, modern
but like in the 1800s.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's such a good idea.
It quickly moved from being practical to also being decorative. There are typically two categories of sashiko design. Moyozashi, which are long lines of running stitches. And hitomizashi, where the pattern is made from an alignment of single running stitches made on a grid. So you can have rows that make a design, or use single running stitches to work up a geometric pattern that you use a grid to design. So you always do from like one side to another, and then like stitches all going one direction, you do those first. And then you go do the opposite direction until you finish your whole design. There are some best practices to help make sure you don't get like a bunched up fabric, and to make sure things are clean, to help secure it in the back. There's a fucking YouTube video for all of it. I learned it 100.
Really,
I learned
cool.
The best practices for doing sashiko embroidery 100% from YouTube.
Hell yeah.
So there are a bunch of traditional Japanese designs. Most of them are rooted in nature and geometry. I recommend going to take a peek at some of the traditional designs. They're really pretty. My personal favorite that I've done on a few things is a persimmon pattern, and it's geometric, and I really like it. I think this is a great hobby for people who want to dip their toes into fiber art. You don't need to buy a bunch of shit, which if you have ADHD, I know that you're prone to buying a bunch of shit for a hobby, getting the dopamine from that, and then never actually doing the hobby. So trying this is really low stakes, really low barrier to entry. The only thing you really need is some scrap fabric, and that could be like old t-shirt. It could be like old sheets. It could be whatever. A thicker needle, like an embroidery or a tapestry needle, but pointy enough to get through your fabric, small enough to not leave huge holes, but big enough to go through a few layers, and big enough to hold cotton thread, thicker cotton thread. So you also just need embroidery thread or crochet thread. They're special sashiko thread. But if you're just starting out, most of the time when I'm mending stuff, I'm using a crochet thread I got from the thrift store for like 50 cents a roll.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It doesn't need to be fancy.
Yeah. And I imagine that traditionally they weren't using special thread for this. They were just using whatever thread they had, I presume.
It was a cotton thread. It was a thick cotton thread. So when you buy sashiko today,
yeah.
It is like the thick cotton thread they'd use. So yeah, it's just nicer, and then there are different types of, I could get into, I might do an episode about fiber type versus weave type versus other things. I might do a fiber art episode, but anyway. So yeah, all you really need is some scrap fabric, a thicker needle, embroidery thread or crochet thread, and a thimble. Thimbles are important, even if you think it doesn't hurt that bad, because repeatedly poking to poke stuff through, you will cause nerve damage. Like, it causes nerve damage to do that unprotected.
Yeah.
But the beautiful thing for sashiko is the most common thimble is a palm thimble, and you can fucking make those yourself. So with sashiko,
really?
You are not moving the needle through the fabric, you are pushing the fabric onto the needle. traditionally.
Oh, interesting.
So if you watch
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, so if you watch videos of people doing it, usually they use their palm to have the needle. They're pushing the fabric in the areas where they want the needle to go in and out, and they use their palm to push it through those layers and pull it out the other side. But you can make your own palm thimble. Like, there's so many on the internet. I've seen someone use a quarter to, like, reinforce their palm thimble with metal.
Oh.
Like, some wild, cool stuff. But I like it.
Cool.
I like it because you extend the longevity of your clothing. I personally like how the stuff I fixed looks around the house. It is a way to fight capitalism. And there are times where, like, I want to be cleaning stuff around the house and taking care of the house, and my body will not allow it. I can still take care of our house and sit down and work on mending.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I literally was doing it this weekend. I was doing a different flavor. I was using a darning loom to fix something. But mending stuff is one of my favorites for when I want to do something, but my brain's being a little spicy. If you are so inclined to try Sashiko and you're like, you kind of want to buy something to get started, I think the thing I would recommend are these really cool adhesive Sashiko guides. These people don't give me money. I just think they make a good thing and they seem like a cool small business. Socorro Society, S-O-C-C-O-R-O. They don't pay me. I just like them. They make these things that you have these adhesive sheets that have the Sashiko grid or a whole pattern laid out, or they even have some shapes like mushrooms and snakes and other things. Mm. You peel and stick this onto the fabric that you are mending, and you follow the lines and sew through your fabric and the adhesive sticker thing. And then it's water soluble. So you wash it, the paper goes away, it's just your design that's left. But when you're trying to start doing this mending, that might be nice. Oh, and my other secret forbidden Sashiko hack that a lot of sewists hate is, instead of pinning my fabric in place to make a patch, I use a basic craft glue, like a glue stick, just a basic glue stick to glue my fabric down so I don't deal with a bunch of pins. You'll wash it, and the glue will go away, and it's fine. Your needles might get sticky, but I'll soak mine in some rubbing alcohol if they do, and they're fine. If I'm gonna be using my sewing machine, I don't want to use the glue because I don't want to fuck up that needle.
Oh, for sure. Definitely.
But if I'm hand sewing, who gives a shit? I'm breaking most of those needles anyway. But yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's awesome. You really have me now. I really want to try it again because I've got stuff I want to sew, and the idea of a palm thimble is like, oh, that I think is what I need because my hands get so achy sometimes. I feel like this is the route.
You want me to make you a palm thimble, baby? I'll make you a palm thimble.
Yeah. If you could show me how to make it.
I'll make you a palm thimble.
You can. Yeah, okay.
I'll make you a palm thimble. I'll give you my plumpy nut.
You can have my beetle dick. That went a little off the rails.
Cock chafer. Before I get to thanking our Patreon supporters, I'd like to make you aware of a mutual aid opportunity. If you go to the link in our show details, you will find a link to our Bellana Arts merch hub. There in the merch hub, you will find a Fuck Ice sticker that Violet has done, and all proceeds from that go to benefit mutual aid here in the Minneapolis area. People are still suffering. Our useless mayor stopped the eviction moratorium. And there are a lot of people struggling to the point that they might lose their homes. So anything we can do to help our neighbors here in Minneapolis recover and still have homes, still have their basic necessities met, is important. So if you want to help out our neighbors here in Minneapolis, you can go to the Bellana Arts merch hub. The link is in the show details, and you will find the Fuck Ice sticker there. I will be making posts when we donate proceeds on both the Mixnomer and my personal Instagram for transparency. And now I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, like Patch, Harleen, Bethany, Laura Kramer, Lilith Rain, Janice Weston, Anarchista, Percy, Nanya B, Kate Michigoose, Kate Genius, Chibs 1012, Dave Peril, Megan E, Carl Brooks, Natasha Neves, Gus, Lutzi, Helen Clifford, Sewing Seraph, Rachel Rachelson, and Fintago. You know the use. You want to help us out, you can tell other people about the show. We don't take paid advertisements, and that means we also don't pay to advertise. So we grow entirely by word of mouth. You all really help us grow. You're the main way we grow is by word of mouth, and it helps us do more podcasting, basically. So if you like what we do, you want to see more stuff from us, you can promote our shows and tell people about it in your favorite subreddit, in your favorite Discord server, in your favorite, I don't know, whatever groups you're meeting in. You tell them about the shows we make. Tell them you like it. Tell them they should check it out. Send them a link. If you want to help us out even further, you can like the show, subscribe to the show, follow the show, whatever language your podcatcher of choice uses, on your podcatcher of choice. Anything we can do to get more interaction on the different podcatchers helps us get recommended to people who might like similar shows to the stuff we make. So you can help us out by making sure you are subscribed, you've left a cute rating, a nice review, a sweet comment, something like that. It helps us get pushed a little more in the algorithms, and it also helps people looking at the show see that the people who listen are active and care enough to engage, which is another thing that gets people to click play. If you're in a place to help us out financially, you can go to the show details and find a link to the Mixnomer Patreon page. Tiers start at just $1, and you get bonus stuff for all the shit we do, all the shit we've done, all the shit we're gonna do. That's where the bonus stuff lives, to varying degrees depending on tiers, but tiers are from $1 to $10. If you're in a place to help us out, you listen to Info Dumpies, you listen to Murphy Bay Magic, you are, you know, a longtime fan of today's lucky winner, and you appreciate independent media, and you can throw some change our way, we greatly appreciate it. And also, if you want to come hang out with us, you will find a link to our Discord server in the show details. The Discord server rules. This weekend, we're going to be doing a stream of Don't Stop Girly Pop on Saturday? Yeah, Saturday. It's a very fun girly first-person shooter. Violet will be playing. I'll be providing color commentary. And we'll all just kind of hang out and enjoy that together. And we do all kinds of fun stuff. Tomorrow we have Stitch and Bitch, which is our regular weekly meeting to do fiber arts and complain about things. You don't even have to be doing fiber arts. We're very loose on that part. Some people just show up, and that's absolutely fine. But that's all I've got for you this time, my friends. Until next time, clever sign-off.